Like, I think it's going to come down to political will. And so that's one of the concerns I have going forward, is I don't really have the answer on whether or not it's going to happen. But I do think that's one of the attack vectors. And so we have this technology that's advancing, whether or not they like it or not. If one country kind of clamps down on it, another country can still, you know, push forward on it. And it could slow adoption in certain areas. But this overall is one of the biggest questions I have. We have kind of a, you know, unstoppable force hitting an immovable object, right? And so, you know, they're not going to give up on the ability to want to be able to track payments. And yet you have this technology that's kind of saying, well, regardless of what you think, I mean, this technology is developing.
Welcome to the Swan Signal Podcast, a production of Swan Bitcoin, the best way to accumulate Bitcoin with automatic recurring buys, instant buys, and wire buys up to $10 million. I'm your host, Brady Swenson, head of education at Swan. Swan Signal Live pairs great guests for compelling discussions about Bitcoin and economics. In this one, Lynn Alden, investment analyst and Swan's lead economic advisor, and Elise Killeen, managing partner at Stillmark, a Bitcoin VC firm. Glad you found your way here. Enjoy. All right, welcome back to Swan Signal Live. This is episode 64. And I'm excited to invite our guests, Elise Killeen and Lynn Alden. We'll get into the show here in just a minute. Our goal here at Swan Bitcoin is to create 10 million new Bitcoiners. And that's not just people who own Bitcoin. It's Bitcoiners who understand why Bitcoin matters and how it works. And to do that, we need to be a partner with you on your Bitcoin journey. So we're dedicated to providing education to our clients through emails, a series that begins as soon as you become a Swan client, to making high-quality books freely available, to making ourselves available to answer your Bitcoin questions anytime you have them, directly from one of our staff who have been in the Bitcoin space for quite some time and are well-versed, to being active on social media platforms like Twitter and Clubhouse, and hosting great conversations between Bitcoiners and economists and technologists. And of course, here on YouTube and on our podcast feed with this show and Swan Lounge on Fridays. You can sign up for Swan at swanbitcoin.com, and we'd be honored to be part of your Bitcoin journey. We provide these services to all of our customers. And if you become a member of Swan Private at swanbitcoin.com/private for individuals, corporations, entities looking to buy over $100,000 worth of Bitcoin over the next 12 months, you'll have access to a dedicated account representative. You'll receive our monthly Swan Private Insight report. We'll provide assistance with tax forms and retirement accounts, self-custody guidance, etc. And of course, wire buys with no limits. We love working with everyone, with all of you. We strive to get better every single day. So if you have any questions or concerns, please do not hesitate to reach out to us at hello@swanbitcoin.com. Okay, so let's get into this one with Elise and Lynn. Elise Killeen is a founding member of the founding managing partner of Stillmark, which is a Bitcoin VC firm. She also sits on the board at Blockstream. And we're also joined by, again, thanks for coming back, Lynn. Lynn is founder of Lynn Alden Investment Strategies, where she provides tens of thousands of investors with monthly research, information, and tools to help them build wealth and reach financial freedom. Lynn is also a deeply appreciated and valued advisor to us here at Swan. You can learn more about Lynn's work at lynnalden.com and about Stillmark at stillmark.com. All right. So welcome, Elise. Welcome, Lynn. Thank you for making the time to join us today.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks, Elise. We have a ton to talk about. We'll start out with SEC Chairman Gensler's comments yesterday. He posted a video on Twitter that sort of laid out his longer format speech at the Aspen Institute. He laid out that, and I think it was interesting because he definitely made a very clear line in the sand between Bitcoin and other crypto assets or cryptocurrencies. He said, This asset class, meaning cryptocurrencies, is rife with fraud, scams, and abuse in certain applications. There's a great deal of hype and spin about how crypto assets work. And in many cases, investors aren't able to get rigorous, balanced, and complete information. Many of these tokens are offered or sold as securities, and he included stable coins in that. But he also said then that though there's a lot of hype masquerading as reality in the crypto field, Nakamoto's innovation is real. Further, it has been and could continue to be a catalyst for change in the fields of finance and money. Very interesting comments, I think significant, even historical in historic in this space. I'll start with you, Lynn. Your thoughts on Gensler's comments yesterday?
Well, he's certainly a pretty informed individual on this topic. He's, I think, he's one of the better people to, you know, to oversee this area. And that, I mean, we have a longstanding question in the industry of which things are commodities, which things are securities. And so there was that article I wrote for Swan. It was a couple months ago now that kind of focused on, you know, that kind of claim that say cryptocurrencies or Bitcoin are Ponzi schemes. And what I did in that article was I walked through how Bitcoin's origin is very different from many of these other types of assets. And so there was no initial coin offering. There was none of these other features that are that you know a large number of these other coins have, and that's part of how it achieved sufficient decentralization, and also made it basically just one of the cleaner origin stories you can possibly have in this space by Satoshi giving himself no inherent advantage compared to any other user that happened to hop on board in the first week or any time in its early stage, and so. As we go forward, I think that's going to be a big question: is what which assets get considered securities? And I think one of the more interesting ones from my perspective is that it seems like Ethereum has been kind of grandfathered in. So even though they did a big ICO, they've there have been previous officials that say they're not necessarily securities, and I'm wondering if that's going to be revisited. And then even if not, I mean that ecosystem, the whole DeFi ecosystem. Does have a lot of coins in the DeFi protocols and in the liquidity protocols that are probably securities, and so it'd be interesting to see how this shakes out.
Elise, I assume that you took a look at some of Gensler's comments. Do you think that these will, make a difference for Bitcoin and as far as it goes in the regulatory industry? And what do you think are the consequences for cryptocurrencies, altcoins, and stable coins in particular too?
Right. So first I'll say that I agree with what Lynn has said, including, the more ambitious things, the conclusions that she's considering, and that Ethereum could be reevaluated, perhaps. I think that's, unlikely, but it'd be interesting to see. And I agree that it's something that probably should be done. I want to speak generally about Gensler's comments rather than specifically because we haven't had the time and I haven't spent the time to really dig in. But I'll say this. I think that he is, as Lynn said, an informed individual. I think it seems as though he understands the tech, and not just the tech, but the incentive systems that exist around it. And we know that Satoshi's real invention was the alignment of incentives in this adversarial environment such that disparate stakeholder groups could kind of work in league with each other. And that's through Bitcoin and through this distributed network. It seems like in addition to Gensler looking at the tech, he's also thought deeply in that way about incentives. And if that's true, then he understands that Bitcoin is inherently different than other cryptocurrencies such that they could be considered even different sorts of asset classes. I think that it's only advantageous to Bitcoin for that distinction to be understood, for its uniqueness to be understood. And Lynn did a great job of sort of outlining those foundational circumstances that allowed Bitcoin to be different. But I think it goes beyond that. And I imagine that that's something that Gensler is weighing. So although the foundation of the founding of Bitcoin was, of course, very different than the founding of Ethereum, we also see the maintenance and sort of progression, the maturation of the protocol, the developer care of the protocol and the upgrades that are introduced. We also see that that's just characteristically different between Bitcoin and other protocols. the London upgrade for Ethereum is a great example of that. So much of the talk around this pending upgrade, 1559 for Ethereum, is around the introduction of a new monetary policy. Bitcoin doesn't need that because we've had stable monetary policy for the past decade. But there's this introduction of a concept, I think a silly concept, of ultrasound money through a new monetary policy. And much of the marketing of the upgrade has been around its impact on price. We know that that exists in contrast to Bitcoin, where the upgrades are generally meant to promote sort of the, the fundamental stability, security, efficiency of the technology. And it's about that robustness rather than any sort of activity happening to boost the price of the asset. And so I suppose that, my summary on my thoughts on this would be that I feel optimistic for Gensler's, impact on the field, in that he's able to differentiate between the sorts of types of tech and the intention of the tech. And if that happens, it's, a positive, not just for Bitcoin, but I think for the communities, the populations that will be impacted by the tech and the existence of cryptocurrency.
Lynn, Ethereum itself, the base layer, and ETH, the token, has been declared previously, a couple of years ago, I believe, as not a security, sufficiently decentralized to be not a security. However, we're looking now at a lot of the tokens built on top of Ethereum as possibly being qualified as a security by the SEC. How do you think that will affect the Ethereum network?
I think it depends on how aggressive they plan to pursue enforcement of that. And so it's one of those things where they could define a lot of things as securities and a lot of their things become unworkable, but they can still go on. And then it'll come down to what extent they try to go after that. And I would say overall that those ecosystems have more attack points than, say, Bitcoin has, because they're more reliant on some of these central hubs in many ways. And so overall, I think that I'd be more concerned about that. And so the way I'm viewing Ethereum at this time is that we see, the new EIP coming out. I do think in the near term, it's probably decent for price in a similar way that a Bitcoin halving might be. But then you have to contrast that with some of these maybe increasing regulatory concerns that affect that ecosystem, perhaps more than the Bitcoin ecosystem. And one way I think about the whole concept of ultrasound money is, if you compared, say, gold, for example, gold is a proof of work system. It's even got a difficulty adjustment because we keep taking out the easy gold deposits and our technology gets better. And so we were able to find, harder to reach gold deposits, but then we get those out. And so we have this kind of, no matter how much our technology progresses, we find ourselves increasing the gold supply by between 1% and 2% a year, almost like clockwork for the past century. And so that's an example of a truly, sound money. Whereas if you had an example where, some country, some fiat currency decided, the president came out and said, hey, we're going to have this new policy where we're going to keep the amount of, money supply by growing by 1.5% per year, no matter what. And so let's say for a few years they do that, the question does become, is that now as sound as gold? And generally, during that process, it might have a similar, benefiting from that low issuance rate. But then the question is, in the future, if there's another administration that comes in, unlike gold, which so far we have no capability to really change the growth rate of that commodity, whereas, in that other kind of self-enforced, supply limitation, that could be changed in the future. And so I think that's one of the distinctions between what makes sound or ultrasound money. It's the question is not just how much is being issued, but can it be changed in the future and by who?
There's also a comment here that made me think about the Lightning Network. And Gensler was talking about how Bitcoin is only used so far as a store of value, whereas the dollar can be used as a store of value, debatable, but also as a medium of exchange and a unit of account. And he's talking about how these use cases aren't used very often yet. And so Bitcoin can best be seen as an asset. This is the one part that concerned me about his comments. He said, regarding medium of exchange. We also haven't seen crypto used much as a medium of exchange to the extent that it is used as such. It's often to skirt our laws with respect to anti-money laundering, sanctions, and tax collection. It also can enable extortion via ransomware, and we recently saw the Colonial Pipeline. So what does this mean for Bitcoin's aspirations to be a medium of exchange, especially via the Lightning Network? And it is being used as a medium exchange increasingly in El Salvador, for instance, for remittances, for instance. These are all sort of buzzwords that we knew were going to come during a cycle of government FUD, you know, the ransomware, the money laundering, et cetera. Do these kind of comments concern you? Are they expected? How do you think it might affect Bitcoin's adoption in the U.S. and other, you know, other countries where these similar laws will be passed? I think Europe is probably even more aggressive on this front so far. Elise, you want to kick off with that one?
Right. So Europe is more aggressive here. That's right. I suppose, you know, so I think of Gensler's comments in the context or in the community from which he comes. And we know that he taught at MIT, you know, alongside one of the founders, one of the innovators of Lightning Network. And, you know, and so that's the reason that I think that we should sit longer with his comments and observe his actions and maybe not read too much into it. But my presumption is that he understands the Lightning Network. He understands the impact of it, even if it just at a high level. And that he's, you know, the comments were perhaps meant to contrast the establishment of Bitcoin as a store of value versus, you know, like the nascent nature of Bitcoin payment capabilities. So all of that said, it's something that he was clear about was his desire to not stymie innovation, you know, at the cost of, you know, at the cost of conservatism, I suppose. And so, you know, I think it was clear from his comments that he's focused, he believes that regulation should be focused on investor protections. And, you know, that makes sense for us. That makes sense for us both as a community, and it makes sense for what we intend the tech to do, which is to empower folks and sort of provide optionality and freedom around finance, including for folks that, you know, have never had anything close to that before, right? So we're looking at providing tools and a platform for banked, unbanked, and underbanked. You know, and understanding where Gary Gensler comes from, I would presume that that's core to how he understands the tech.
And Lynn, your thoughts on this medium of exchange and then dropping all of the, you know, crypto is used for anti-money laundering, extortion, et cetera.
So I agree with everything she said. And I do think that this is going to be kind of a regulatory question that's probably going to stick around with us for years as we kind of work our way through this, because on one hand, you have censorship payment, censorship resistant payments, right? The ability to send payments without any kind of centralized third party being able to block you. At the same time, as we have countries around the world trying to clamp down on private types of transactions. And so we've seen, for example, in Europe over the past couple of years, they've reduced the threshold. If someone buys gold, what threshold has to be like reported? You see that happening. We also see, for example, Europe's considering banning larger cash transactions. And so this is kind of a, you know, kind of a something that's interesting in society, because we never really agreed to this. There was no really public debate on this. It just kind of has been an encroaching thing over time, where it's kind of presumed that you don't really have privacy for most transactions anymore. And that wasn't really something that most people seem to sign up for yet. And it's one thing, of course, to enforce, you know, it doesn't mean that just because you're doing something privately that you can do illegal things. I mean, obviously, they want to go after the big fish that are doing things that are, you know, against national security and things like that. But overall, this is, it's going to be a challenging area, I think. I mean, for example, you know, I think one of the most innovative spaces in Bitcoin is Lightning Network. It's, you know, it's basically if you send a payment, I mean, that's a taxable event, right? Because you're leaving, you know, you have a commodity, a Bitcoin, and you've now sent a fraction of it away. That's a taxable event. That can certainly complicate things. And then we go down kind of, you know, we see instances, especially in a lot of other markets. I mean, I think it was The Guardian that just had a recent article that was kind of pretty favorable towards Bitcoin, and showing why it's some of the impact it's had in Nigeria, for example. And we see, for example, that the government would shut down protesters' bank accounts, but they could stay funded through Bitcoin. We also saw, for example, merchants were trying to do simple business, like with textiles or whatever they might be doing. And there's there's protections in place to try to prevent the currency from weakening. There's all these kind of blocks on FX exchange rates, and they could go around those. And so that's one of those things that it's kind of like moral yet going around the government systems, right? So few people would say what those things are doing is immoral, but under certain regimes, those types of free activities are illegal. And so there's kind of that I think public debate between morality and privacy versus illegality, because they're not necessarily the same thing. And so this is, we're going to have more clarity in the space, I think, to make sure innovation and use cases can keep happening, while, of course, making sure that people aren't committing tax fraud. There's that firm chain analysis. I mean, they show the stats for the percentage of Bitcoin transactions. I mean, they work with law enforcement. They analyze the chain for this reason. And we see the numbers that, basically Bitcoin has a very low, crypto in general has a very low percentage of criminal activity on chain, because for most transactions, cash is still a better medium than Bitcoin for private illegal types of transactions, and so it's one of those things where privacy shouldn't necessarily imply that someone is doing something illegal. It just means that they're trying to do their business. And so I think this is part of a much bigger question about types of capital controls or kind of anti-privacy measures in the space, and that Bitcoin's maybe at the center of it, but it also affects gold and cash and basically any sort of bearer instrument.
So, but do you think that this is an attack vector that's emerging on Bitcoin? Because the Lightning Network is inherently private with its onion routing, et cetera. And that was honestly one of the kind of goals of the Lightning Network, to correct the relative transparency of the Bitcoin blockchain. And so building a private peer-to-peer cash system without any intermediate third party. So as the Lightning Network continues to gain adoption, do you see, companies that Strike and other, wallets that use Lightning and make Lightning easily usable, could be targets for regulation?
I think they certainly could be. I think it's going to come down to political will. And so that's one of the concerns I have going forward, is I don't really have the answer on whether or not it's going to happen. But I do think that's one of the attack vectors. And so we have this technology that's advancing, whether or not they like it or not. If one country kind of clamps down on it, another country can still, push forward on it. It could slow adoption in certain areas. But this overall is one of the biggest questions I have. We have kind of a, unstoppable force hitting an immovable object, right? And so, they're not going to give up on the ability to want to be able to track payments. And yet you have this technology that's kind of saying, well, regardless of what you think, I mean, this technology is developing. I think years ahead, we're going to have clashes, and different countries are going to handle it differently. And I wish I could say, I think which countries are going to handle it better than others. I don't know that yet, but it is something I'm watching pretty closely.
Yeah, I'm definitely concerned about it as well. And obviously I want the Lightning Network to succeed and to be something that exists in the world. And we absolutely need private peer-to-peer payments as an anti-authoritarian tool, capital controls, et cetera. So I will obviously be on the front lines fighting for the Lightning Network as well. We just need to be aware of it, I think. Lise, did you have anything to say about those thoughts before we move on?
So I think it makes sense to acknowledge how storytelling is important here. And so really what one of the things that Lynn was saying is that if the least privileged folks are able to use the technology, then that really means that anyone can, including folks that might have, a desire to use the technology for to buy drugs or something like this. But storytelling can sort of bridge, that gap between what's actually happening and, the things that folks in government or otherwise might fear. And so this is one of the reasons why it's particularly exciting to me that El Salvador emerging markets could be some of the first to really truly adopt Bitcoin and through the Lightning Network, because we know that the folks that will be most in need there or seem to be adopting most quickly are those that are unbanked. And we also see that the motivation that exists behind, government leaders in those markets are to help their unbanked or underbanked populations get access to financial tools. And so to be able to represent those stories when we're talking about Lightning Network is quite important. And of course, if Bitcoin is able to be used as money or to transact, of course, it will not just be used for buying coffee. It'll be used broadly and for many things. But as Lynn said, to be anti-Bitcoin in terms of how folks can transact is to really be anti-cash as well, because cash is much better way to participate in the illicit dark markets. And Bitcoin is a much more dangerous manner of transacting, for example, in vice industries or to buy drugs, something like this. And so how we talk about this will be important. And I'm, really sort of my optimism stems from the adoption we see in emerging markets, stories being told by folks like Alex Gladstein, and being able to center some of those stories will be important in educating regulators.
I think that's a huge point. I think, basically there's always going to be these anecdotal instances like the Colonial Pipeline. And so it's important to counter those with other types of anecdotal instances, as well as just the broad industry numbers. And so it's one of those things where the numbers really favor the technology, in my view. And so I think the big thing is kind of keeping ahead of the narrative and making sure that people don't get it in their head that just, Bitcoin is enabled in these giant things. It's like putting those numbers into perspective compared to the other things that it's contributing towards.
Yeah, I mean, there are private ways to do payments that aren't Bitcoin. So this is not like Bitcoin is not introducing, a new way to conduct illegal activities. So it's not changing the world much in that regard. So we're talking about the Lightning Network. I had this on the agenda. I want to go back and talk about the infrastructure bill, but let's go ahead and move on to the Lightning Network. And Elise was recently on the Odd Lots podcast. I think that's a Bloomberg podcast. And talking about DeFi on Lightning. And, you're correctly saying that Bitcoin is DeFi. Let's just get that, get that clear. And of course, Lynn recently shared the stage at Bitcoin 2021 with Elizabeth Stark. And I know that you are increasingly interested in Lightning. So I'd just like to start with a fun question. What are you excited about on the Lightning front? Elise, we'll start with you.
So I've been talking a lot lately about the ability to denominate payment channels, Lightning channels, in dollars. So, and I spent a bit of time on that, I think, with BTC Sessions on one of his Friday panels, and I'll just repeat that here. But one of the things that Taproot sort of set us on a path for was dollar-denominated payment channels on the Lightning Network. And the way that could happen in the nearest term, there's several mechanisms for doing this, but the way that's likely to happen in the nearest term is for a payment channel to be defined by a DLC, a discrete log contract, such that the channel is Bitcoin collateralized, of course, but the balance of the channel is defined by the exchange rate introduced by an oracle via DLC. So all that means is that within a certain range of volatility, that channel can be balanced and rebalanced so that one side of the channel is holding the value in that channel in USD or in pesos, for instance. And why that's so impactful, I think, especially in the short or midterm, is that much of the argument around why Bitcoin is not useful in an emerging market is that folks in emerging markets don't have the capacity to withstand Bitcoin's current volatility. And we have to acknowledge that that's true. That makes a lot of sense. If a circular economy doesn't exist yet in completeness within that own individual's local market, then of course volatility can be difficult to manage. But being able to exist in the Bitcoin ecosystem via the Lightning Network and have channels denominated in your local currency sort of removes that friction point, or at least to a degree removes that friction point, and then allows people in emerging markets to get the value of the technology. So the instant permissionless and nearly free transaction capability without having to tolerate, the risk of volatility. And so what I imagine that can look like is that folks would hold perhaps a savings account in Bitcoin while holding a checking account or the money that they intend to spend within a month's time or a week's time in fiat denominated stable channels. And so while there's just a ton, like Lynn said at the top of the show, going on in the Lightning space, and some of the most exciting innovation in Bitcoin and in cryptocurrency more broadly is happening on Bitcoin's Lightning network layer. But stable channels specifically, I think, have such a breadth of relevance that Stillmark is trying to spend a lot of time right there.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I haven't looked into that much. And it reminds me, though, on kind of your first explanation of it that I've heard, of what El Salvador is doing, where, they guarantee that merchants who are being, required by law to accept Bitcoin don't have to take the Bitcoin at all. It's instantly transferred or into their native currency, or I guess dollars, right? So it's similar, but actually, in the protocol itself, it doesn't require a government fund to facilitate that exchange. Is that kind of what's going on?
I think that's right. And then I also think when we're talking about emerging markets onboarding to Bitcoin via Lightning Network, then it's important, I think, to realize the significance of Lightning Network kind of removing the dynamic of what remittances are or what they used to be, because we can just transact globally without needing to go through a fiat to fiat exchange. And one of the reasons why that's so compelling is because in emerging markets, the friction and cost of remittance is so burdensome that there's a real acute need here and an immediate value that can be provided through the Lightning Network, whether that be through Bitcoin on the Lightning Network or the Lightning Network just used almost as a rail for a fiat payment or exchange. And so what's been most exciting for me in the past 12 months is to see this almost feedback loop or a lucky convergence of events between what's happening at the protocol level and then what's happening in terms of adoption. And so as we continue to see, a sort of overlap of these things, I think that favors an acceleration of Bitcoin's growth.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're seeing, additional improvements to the Lightning Network coming out now that Taproot is here. It will enable like any prev outs, and then L2, which is much less data intensive, simpler implementation of Lightning channels. So it's great to see that protocol continue to improve as well, and we'll only see more and more of that over the years as Bitcoin's protocol will start to kind of ossify. Lightning's ossification is way out in the future, mm-hmm. and can continue to be improved. Do you think that Bitcoin or that Lightning will end up being something like akin to a partner to the base layer, so that like in the future, improvements and applications will be built on top of something that's sort of analogous to TCP/IP? Some people call it LNP/BP as a sort of partnered base layer for the transfer of wealth across the internet.
I think that makes sense. That would be my sort of null hypothesis as to what happens. But what's important, for us to do as venture investors in the space is to be, not to lead here. So we're observing what right. developers find is the best path towards scaling and to the introduction of new utility. And so our real work is to watch what's happening on the protocol roadmap, both at Bitcoin base layer and sidechains on Lightning Network, and then to sort of start to imagine what that means for app developers or infrastructure developers whose work will be impacted by the unlocking of this sort of new utility. While I would suspect that the way these layers develop will be similar to what we saw to you know, the maturation of the internet. We're also open to something else emerging here. And I am really sort of, you know, most grateful for the level of engineering talent that exists in this space and the rigor of their work in considering the trade-offs of, you know, of their work and of what's done at these various layers. And so, you know, I mean, and I think that it's probably one of the few things that are most key in differentiating Bitcoin from any of the other protocols and cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, Lynn, you were an engineer for quite some time. And I wonder when you approach analyzing Lightning from that engineering mind, do you see this sort of developing in the same way that the internet has developed as a stack of protocols? And, you know, who knows what happens from the base of LNPBP?
That, I mean, definitely, you know, from an engineering perspective, I think that's what excites me is seeing the modular development that you can have different groups working on very different things. And we don't have to see exactly which area is going to succeed because we know we have a really strong foundation underneath. And rather than trying to kind of, you know, change things on the fly in the base layer, we see that the base layer is pretty ossified, and then we go forward with these other layers and see what works. And so, for example, yeah, the idea of stable channels certainly appeals to me. I think I heard that first. You mentioned it on Preston's podcast, and I thought that was a really neat kind of example. And for me, it's the overall network effect that we're seeing kind of blossom on the Lightning Network. And so, for example, a lot of the DeFi protocols or things like that, you can kind of, they can grow very quickly. Whereas the way that Lightning works is it's all about liquidity. And so, you know, in addition to the development work being done, that takes just long periods of time to build those channels and to build that liquidity. And so, you know, now we seem to be seeing that over the past year or so, it's really reaching a critical mass in terms of usability. I see a lot of people saying how they used to try to send payments, they'd often fail, but now they're able to reliably send these moderately large payments through the network. And so it's achieving that kind of sufficient liquidity, you know, density, along with all sorts of new tools that have been coming out. And then I'm interested to see what's happening with these layer three technologies, things like Impervious or Sphinx, where now increasingly Lightning is not necessarily just for transmitting value, but also information. And so it's interesting because from the beginning, even in Nakamoto's own writing, the idea of Bitcoin was it was kind of a purely monetary good. And so many other historical commodity monies, you know, basically it was something with utility, but that, you know, but then it would require a monetary premium. Whereas Bitcoin is interesting because, you know, from the beginning, say Satoshi described it as like a commodity that is not really useful for many things, with the exception that it can be sent over a transmission media. It can be sent over a network. And so for a while, that's how Bitcoin's operated, as this pure utility money, where the utility is the ability to send permissionless payments or to self-custody your own assets. But now it's actually fascinating that we saw a pure 100% monetary good actually start to develop these non-monetary utilities. Basically, the ability to transmit information in that same decentralized way. And so those are still very new technologies. And so we'll see how that develops. But I think that the fact that the overall space is kind of reaching this critical mass is what excites me. And that, you know, basically Lightning and some of these other sort of second layer, third layer solutions, they're basically where Bitcoin was in like 2012, 2013, where, you know, they're not on most people's radar. They're still early stages. But I think that they're really promising. And I think looking back, say 5 years from now, I think there's going to be a lot that happens in this whole ecosystem.
Yes, absolutely. This development, real quick before we move on, and I want to get into the infrastructure bill, but we have these DeFi products that are on top of Ethereum right now. A lot of them are really just used for speculation and traders as casinos to play. Do you see that coming onto Bitcoin, or do you see maybe more, I guess, companies with larger, more, let's just put it like, you know, more serious, more established banking companies, for instance, in the traditional legacy system, starting to build their services on top of Bitcoin as opposed to Ethereum? I mean, wouldn't you think that they would choose Bitcoin for, you know, it's more established, more greater network effects, et cetera, more decentralized? as opposed to something like Ethereum. What do you think, Elise?
So I think first, you know, it's important to acknowledge the trade-offs that exist between decentralized and centralized systems. And I think this is, you know, actually Ethereum's real danger, is that there's sort of this, you know, like, to my mind, you know, illusion or like lip service paid to decentralization, when, you know, it's not apparent to me that the community, you know, is necessarily cares, or that's, you know, even necessarily that's something, like a trait that's assumed to exist in Ethereum. And so, the reason why that's a risk is because there's a cost of decentralization and there's some inefficiency of decentralization. And so if you are, you know, proposing yourself to be decentralized when really you are centralized, there's a cost to that. And I think that Ethereum's sort of competitors, these more centralized chains that, you know, also lead with smart contracts. So like the Solanas of the world, I think that, you know, there's a risk for Ethereum in continuing to try to, you know, present themselves as a decentralized smart contracting platform when, you know, they're going to be facing and are already facing very serious competition from more centralized smart contracting platforms. So, you know, so anyhow, so I want to acknowledge that as context here. Now, what we've seen, so if we know that Ethereum leads on utility, and we know that Bitcoin leads on security and stability, robustness of the protocol. And so what we expect to see, what I would expect to see, is Bitcoin emerge first, and perhaps singularly as a store of value, and then Ethereum to introduce utilities that will later be adopted by Bitcoin. So in my work as a venture capitalist focused on Bitcoin, I spend a lot of time watching what's happening on the Ethereum side so that we can understand where there's a positive market reaction to this utility. And so in this cycle, what we've seen is that there is a smaller but very engaged audience for DeFi trading. And of course, that will be possible on Bitcoin. So there are companies already building that. There are very talented teams building AMAs, automatic market makers, on Bitcoin sidechains. And, you know, frankly, I think that there's likely some, you know, trading advantages to operating you know, trading on a Bitcoin sidechain versus on an Ethereum layer. So that's, you know, sort of thing one, but it goes beyond just DeFi starting in a space that leads with utility and being ported over to Bitcoin. It goes beyond that because Ethereum, in a way, can sort of be a testnet in terms of viable applications for a blockchain protocol. And so we're watching that. We're looking to see, you know, like I said, what works, where there's market interest. And then, you know, we'll track founders to see who we think can really win there on the Bitcoin side. One more piece that I want to add here, which is just that, though, you know, 90% of my day, 80% of my day is spent talking to founders building on Bitcoin, I am talking to founders that are building on other protocols. And many, many of those folks are waiting for Bitcoin to be ready to switch over to being based on Bitcoin. And so, you know, I mean, so an example of that could be the Atomic Finance folks, right, that are offering DeFi through DLCs now on Bitcoin's core protocol, that started off building these sorts of trading products in the Ethereum space, decided that the protocol and programming language didn't offer the security assurances that were necessary for a mature trading environment, and so switched over to a Bitcoin environment. It's not just Atomic Finance that's looking at this. There's many developers in that same boat, and we know that the end users of these sorts of applications, especially DeFi applications, are not religiously, you know, committed to the underlying protocol. We saw that, for example, when Uniswap had this sort of, you know, attack from SushiSwap, the traders shifted platforms. And so we know that once these apps and infrastructures and sort of use cases exist in a Bitcoin environment, if those Bitcoin founders are serving the end users best, then the end users will switch. And so we pay attention broadly to this sort of activity happening in, blockchain protocol spaces generally, looking for the moment that activity will be able to be live on Bitcoin.
And I know the Atomic Finance guys have also commented that they came over to Lightning because it was much easier to develop on than Bitcoin, the Bitcoin base layer. And so I think we're starting to reach par with Ethereum's scripting language.
That's very important. So I think that one of the things that I'm most looking forward to is the presence of, tools and language that opens the doors for more developers to be active in developing on Lightning or on Bitcoin, on Bitcoin sidechains. I think that right now Bitcoin is very advantaged in that we have 90% of the top decile of blockchain developers building on Bitcoin. But one of the sort of FUD opportunities for, folks in other spaces is that all the developers, right? We hear this often, all the developers are building on Ethereum. This is not true. Of course, it's not true. But I think we only stand to gain from having more developers, building in Bitcoin spaces. And so we're moving in that direction in terms of tooling and programming languages. And that makes me very bullish for ecosystem development in Bitcoin.
Yeah, likewise. Lynn, do you have any thoughts about DeFi moving to Bitcoin or where, future companies, are they platform agnostic? Will they choose to move to Bitcoin because it's better in some ways that they value?
One thing I started tracking earlier this year was the stablecoin migration. It used to run on Omni. Then it shifted over to, we started to see Tether, for example, running on Ethereum, of course. And then now as Ethereum fees started to get pretty high, we started to see them spill over onto Tron. I think now it's basically has reached a larger amount of Tron. Now, still the Ethereum ones have higher velocity, if I last checked correctly. But basically, we've seen that spillover, and now we're seeing, say, USDC, issue tokens on Solana, and so we see, for example, that the stablecoin usage is relatively flexible with whatever underlying blockchain it's on, as long as they're able to do the services they're trying to do. I think the Uniswap to SushiSwap example was another good example that was still within the same ecosystem, but it was from a one hub to another hub within that same space. And so right now we Ethereum is the only other ecosystem that I consider to have a really large network effect, and so it does have that going for it. But I do think that as the tools get better on Bitcoin, we can see some of that, or at least whether or not it takes away from that ecosystem, we'll see. But I think you could at least have it growing on this side as well. And we'll see how much maybe moves back and forth. But we started to see, for example, now we have Sovereign and these other DeFi sort of protocols that are going in a similar direction that we saw on Ethereum. But of course, I would argue that on Bitcoin they have a little bit more solid footing to be operating on. And of course, they don't have the scale and liquidity that you see on the Ethereum sides, but they're newer. And so I'm interested to see how that develops over time. And it's one of those things where ecosystems are going to be used for different things. And so the Ethereum ecosystem tends to be oriented towards multi-token trading and leveraging, whereas the Bitcoin community is inherently, not everyone's a maxi, right? I mean, some of them are still willing to trade other tokens, but generally that's probably going to catch on less rapidly than you see on the Ethereum ecosystem. And so I think, you might have different use cases kind of specialize on different types of ecosystems. But overall, I think that the general idea of seeing other things occur on other blockchains, and then when the technology is ready to implement those in a safe and solid way on Bitcoin, is the way that I'm kind of watching this play out as well.
Awesome. All right. So we had this infrastructure bill that has been going through the process for a while now, but recently, I guess last week, there was a provision inserted that basically was intended to create tax revenue from crypto. And it was probably worded much more broadly than it ought to be, because it was written by someone who didn't really understand what was going on. What are your thoughts on how the community has responded to this development and the progress that we're seeing toward a more sane language in that provision? Lynn, you can start with this one.
So I think it's actually it's good to see that there's been a bipartisan pushback on the wording of that bill. So it's one of those things. Bitcoin shouldn't really be a right or left issue. Shouldn't be Republican or Democrat. It's an international asset. There are obviously different groups that benefit from that. And so the initial wording was problematic. I mean, I've seen, for example, if you just replace the word person with customer in one instance, it would have largely probably fixed the issue. Because they're basically talking about transferring coins for other people. That's very different if you change it to customer, right? So that means that an exchange has to do something, whereas like a hardware wallet maker or a miner or a validator or a Lightning node, those are very different, beasts than an exchange. But since then, there are some of the senators that introduced a more, instead of just changing that one word, they actually had a number of clauses that they want to add to it. To further explicitly exclude certain types of operators. And so we'll see what makes it into the final language. But it is useful. I mean, even the person I think that was in behind the original language kind of later clarified it's not really what they meant. But you don't want that to be in the law so that a later interpreter could then, use it against industries in a way that slows them down. I think it's one of those things that we have to keep educating, Congress and other countries and their legislative bodies on how this technology works. And one of the points that I've been making for a while, again, it goes back to the network effect, where the bigger Bitcoin gets and the ecosystem as a whole, but I would say especially Bitcoin, the bigger it gets, the more that you have the ear of politicians to basically make sure that they're understanding what's going on. And so, many years ago, there was no Bitcoin lobby or no cryptocurrency lobby, whereas now there's actually groups that interface with these politicians to make sure that they don't inadvertently kind of slow down innovation when it wasn't even their intention. And so it's one thing. I mean, when you do these types of large funding bills, it is common to have one of the revenue levers be stepping up enforcement on some type of tax, because that's obviously less controversial to the public than a new tax to say, we're going to step up enforcement of capital gains taxes or this other type of tax. And so that general idea of what they're doing makes sense. I mean, obviously, they want to make sure that there's a level playing field in terms of taxes. But I am just overall happy to see that there has been kind of pushback and that it's not just coming from one party or the other, but it's just kind of, it's not really a left versus right issue. It's more of a, either you understand the tech or you don't. And so I'm happy to see that that's kind of, starting to trickle its way into the bill.
I absolutely agree with that. Elise, your thoughts?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, Bitcoiners are not a monolith. The tech is not, very much not political. And in fact, I think that, there's arguments to be made that it could be, a real tool of power for the agenda of both parties. So for instance, Elizabeth Warren coming out very, with force, seemingly against Bitcoin is very odd if what she's, intending to do is to provide democratized access to financial tools, which I think is how she spent, what she spent most of her career promoting. And so I suppose that it's incumbent upon the community to make sure that we're represented not as a monolith and that the tech does not seem political, but rather a tool of, financial access and freedom. And I think that this is something that hopefully unites both parties, at least in terms of their public arguments. And, it feels to me like there's the pace of education and sort of, sophisticated understanding of both who's building in the Bitcoin space, as well as the intention behind what's being built. We still have a lot of work to do there, but the folks working on it are just, so talented and I hope are well enough resourced by contributions from the community. And so, when I say this specifically, I want to mention and call out the brilliant work that's happening at Coin Center to make sure that folks on both sides of the aisle are as educated as best as they allow themselves to be on the tech. And as people learn more about Bitcoin, I expect that we'll see leaders in both parties sort of want to place a flag here and be early to lead on how the technology can advance their own goals.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Lynn. Just to add, if you look in technology history, this is a pattern that goes through multiple times. And so when the internet came out, it's only for like gamblers and pornographers and people that want to do illicit activities. But of course, 99% of the internet became a much larger thing than that. And of course, there's a history of criminals adopting to technology faster because it's their incentive to do so. That's one thing is if they get there first, but then as the industry matures, that's when you see it fill out with all the more constructive use cases. The same thing, I highlighted an example, I think it was from the 80s. It was like a quote from the Washington Post about beepers, and that beepers caught on among drug dealers because they could alert themselves to police very effectively. But of course, beepers were a great technology for doctors and other types of on-call professions, and it became a very common use case. It just so happens that criminals were shrewd and they have a more incentive to rapidly kind of adapt to these things than others. And so that's going to be a kind of a narrative that impacts any type of new technology, and we've been seeing it with Bitcoin over the past decade, where of course it has some of those early use cases. There still is the occasional use case, but I think that more and more politicians are waking up to the fact that this is a big area of innovation in general, and that criminal use cases represent a very small percentage of the remaining transactions that's still occur in that space.
And criminal use cases also are an indication that the tech is working and that the network is decentralized. And so that's a necessary component for Bitcoin to be a financial tool for folks that have less privilege. And so we should be, I think that it's a positive sign that folks can use Bitcoin to buy drugs. I think that's, it won't represent the bulk of activity happening in Bitcoin, but because it's happening, we know that Bitcoin is decentralized. And so I think it's a positive indication. And once decentralization and the value of it is better understood by, folks in Congress, I suspect that we'll see less attention paid on the importance or significance of illicit use of Bitcoin.
Yeah, and we should say that Bitcoin can also be used and probably will be used much more to escape from criminals, authoritarians, capital controls, etc. So I know that there are many cases around the world, countries that people and citizens there could use Bitcoin to better their situation or have a better outcome. Also, just wanted to mention real quick, thanks for shouting out Coin Center, and everyone should consider supporting them however you can. We talk a lot about education, educating people about Bitcoin as they adopt it, and that is just as important for lawmakers to be educated about what's going on. So they're doing great work. Lynn, I wanted to turn to you. We have about 10 minutes left, so I wanted to turn to you to see if you could give us kind of a quick update on the macro situation and what is your latest base case for Bitcoin over the next 6-12 months?
Yeah, well, the current issue with the biggest macro question right now is probably inflation. That's one of the bigger things because we had that, over 5% inflation print year over year in the United States, which is, I think, to be expected when you had this much money supply growth. And it's coming in certain waves, right? So we had, there's areas of bottlenecks. So you had the lumber spike and then that cooled off. That was specifically a sawmill constraint. Then you have, the semiconductor shortage it's manifesting most directly in the CPI in terms of used cars. And that's just showing signs of perhaps topping or cooling off as well. And so the next thing this autumn that I'm watching is rent inflation, because we're seeing early signs of rent inflation. And we're, it's starting to kind of bottom, I think, and start to roll up. And of course, we'll see how pushing back some of these eviction moratoriums affect that. But as we go forward, basically we have a lot more money in the system. It's something like 35% more broad money now than at the start of 2020. And that's, that filters into prices over time. And so whatever's scarce, essentially. And so, you know, there's some areas that are so disinflationary that they're not seeing price increases. Like I've used the example of like men's suits, for example. They're not inflating in price, but because there's no shortage of them at all. Whereas, you know, it was certain types of commodities, certain types of semiconductors, and now increasingly it looks like rent is gonna catch up with some of the appreciation we've seen in real estate prices, and so we're also seeing a pretty wide labor shortage, and so that can push up wages potentially. That's still kind of an ongoing issue because employers, I think, are in some cases waiting to see what happens with some of these unemployment benefits rolling off, because that might give them a little bit more bargaining pressure. And so we'll see how that plays out over time. But, inflation doesn't have to be that hot when yields are this low for, fiat currencies to not be very good stores of value. Because even at this current time, their negative real yields are pretty significant in inflation-adjusted terms. And so that overall dynamic certainly is good for assets like Bitcoin. As for the next 6 to 12 months of price action, I'm kind of watching to see what some of the technicals do here. I try not to think too much in these shorter term increments, but overall, I think it's constructive when you look out a year. I think some of the things that could weigh it down perhaps are if consumers get a little bit more pinched in terms of their cash spending, they can put less money into investments as they were maybe last year, right? When they were receiving stimulus checks, some of that could go directly into Bitcoin or, Doge, whatever they were buying at the time. It could be AMC stock, but I mean, some of that was getting into Bitcoin. But then we're starting to see, for example, signs that the consumer will be a little bit more pinched going forward. And so that's a downward pressure. But then most other things I would say are up. And so the fact that real yields are persistently negative now, I don't think the market is maybe fully, anticipating some of the rent increases that we could see is something I'll be watching pretty closely. And so overall, I think that's a pretty favorable situation for Bitcoin. And then we just have to watch what happens with some of the supply shocks, right? Because there's only so much supply that's coming on. We're seeing, some of these miners in North America plan to retain most of the Bitcoin that they're mining. And so there's really not a ton of new supply coming into the market. And so, as long as there's still that kind of ongoing dollar cost averaging among small buyers, I think we're also, I'm interested to see what happens with some of these growing numbers of credit cards that let you earn sats with your purchases. That's like another form of kind of ongoing dollar cost averaging, essentially. This kind of low-key buying pressure that's always there up against a very constrained supply. And so I'm still kind of long-term favorable. And just kind of watching the price action in the near term to see if it can start breaking up out of some of these lower levels.
Elise, do you have anything to comment on?
I love listening to Lynn talk about this.
Likewise.
So I guess I would just, so we think about Bitcoin's intrinsic value in a couple ways. So we think about adoption, which perhaps there's an overlap in the concept of adoption with Lynn's argument around network effect. And then we think about breadth of utility. And as the third bucket, we think about, days of the Bitcoin network existing as a secure and stable protocol with a stable monetary policy. And so, Lynn said she likes to look out, in the midterm, like a year, 6 months. From a venture perspective, we're really looking at, a 6, a 7, an 8 year sort of term. And so this is why I'm thinking, more about concepts like adoption, network effect, or just the fact that the protocol is stable. And the promises Satoshi left us with, have been regarded and are secure. One of my favorite things about Bitcoin that I like to explain to folks when they're deciding how to come into the cryptocurrency space, do they want to come in through Bitcoin or another asset? You can buy Bitcoin and walk away for a decade and come back and find your Bitcoin right there. You've not had to do anything in terms of, like switching the software that you're using, or, you're kind of just set. You can set it and forget it. And I think the fact that Bitcoin exists in that way as years accumulated, it adds to, the fundamental value that it offers.
All right. Absolutely. 5 minutes to go. So this is a big question. So we're going to see how it's going to have to be answered quickly. But do you, I'm going to start with Lynn on this one. Do you subscribe or see any value in the idea of monetary maximalism, especially like if there is a globally available currency that's independent from any governments like Bitcoin that will eventually be adopted as the single global money? Or do you see Bitcoin evolving as an alternate system alongside, you know, some fiat currencies or CDBCs that are, you know, represented by or enforced by the largest, richest countries?
So I'm kind of watching this play out in stages rather than try to look and say what's going to happen, say over a decade in the future. And so it's one of those things where, you know, like to what Elise pointed out, I watch the network effects pretty heavily. And so, for example, in my research service, you know, even when we had this weaker price action, one of the things I've been covering a lot is the Lightning Network and kind of the, you know, kind of stress to my readers of this ongoing development that's happening in the space. And so when it applies to using it as a reserve asset, you know, it's one of those things where it's still, you know, at the moment, it's a sub $1 trillion market cap. It's still pretty volatile. But one of my overall kind of research directions is showing that the world is, you know, the financial center of the world is kind of becoming a little bit more decentralized. And so instead of just the dollar being used to buy global energy, global commodities, and being over 60% of foreign exchange reserves, we're starting to see more over the world that, you know, we see, for example, Russia is selling more of its energy in euros. It's de-dollarized its reserves, both with China and with Europe. It's increasingly shifting towards the euro. It's also, you know, with India, it's starting to de-dollarize to some extent. And we see these kind of you know, more global, you know, multi-currency. So instead of having like one kind of world currency, you have more of these regional reserve currencies. We also see, of course, China is working on making their CBDC, you know, rolling out in the next couple of years. One of their ambitions is to be able to buy commodities in their local currency. So far, there's, you know, this evidence they've been doing it marginally, but they want to be able to accelerate that to some extent. And so in that world of these, you know, multiple different kind of currency centers, you know, neutral bearer assets are very helpful. And so we've seen, for example, over the past 10 years, central banks have been buying more gold as part of their reserves, because what they essentially get is an inflation-adjusted asset with no counterparty risk, and they didn't want to go overboard on gold. I mean, they're not trying to speculate on gold's price, but they're using it as an asset that they can just kind of tuck away for decades, and if they need to, they can exchange that and support their currency or buy external goods if needed. And so you see, for example, we see Russia is orienting its reserves towards kind of a combination of gold and euro-based assets. That's kind of the center of what it's doing, which makes sense considering their trading partners. Whereas, you know, you might see other countries go in other directions. And if Bitcoin were to get big enough, that can start fitting into reserves. You could see it in some of the smaller countries. They can also use the fact that it's got permissionless payment capabilities, so it can go around sanctions. So in addition to the store of value, it also has that backup utility. But then, you know, if you were to get greater and greater adoption, if you get more than a billion people holding Bitcoin, if it grows in market capitalization, reduces in volatility, I see no reason why it couldn't start showing up in some of the more tech-savvy balance sheets of the world. But it's, you know, instead of kind of looking out much further than that, I'd say let's see how this process goes in the next couple of years. Let's see how this currency, you know, this monetary system kind of decentralizes. But I think it could serve a similar role in those assets. And then the El Salvador news was just kind of remarkable. I'm curious to see if any follow in that direction.
Elise?
So, you know, I, just as Lynn said, we're watching it happen in increments and, you know, then being responsive to that. But the companies that we're investing in basically, you know, should allow folks to have the option of, you know, basically denominating their own life in Bitcoin. But that all said, what I hope happens is that emerging markets are first to adopt, like El Salvador and the countries that have signaled they want to be second followers. I hope that they are first to adopt and gain it, you know, in oversized reward as a result of that. So it would be absolutely, you know, a beautiful accomplishment of the tech and of Satoshi's innovation if there were to be some sort of leveling out of opportunity between, you know, geographies as a result of folks being able to and having the appetite for moving quickly and being a leader here. And so to see El Salvador do that, you know, I'm rooting for them. And I hope that in what they learn through this process, that other similar countries can, you know, follow suit, taking advantage of, you know, the things that worked for them and then avoiding the pitfalls. And there'll be pitfalls or difficulties, friction points for sure. And then it's what we do with them in terms of gaining insight for similar countries that will be most important.
Awesome. Thank you both so much for joining me today. This was a lot of fun. Thank you, everyone, for coming to watch as well. So, Elise, Lynn, if you have any final words, please feel free to share them.
I think we covered a lot of things.
We did.
Oh, go ahead.
Thank you for having me. It was, this is my first time being on a panel or in a public discussion with Lynn. That's a pleasure and a great opportunity. Thank you for that. And it's always good to chat Bitcoin with other Bitcoiners. It always leaves me more optimistic for the future than even how I came in.
Yeah, likewise. It was so nice to meet you. And thank you, Brady, for putting this together.
Yeah, thank you, Lynn. Thanks, Elise. All right, we will let our ghosts take off. And I'll just talk to you all for 1 minute again about Swan. You know, you all, I think a lot of you probably know about Swan at swanbitcoin.com. And we are here to help guide you on your Bitcoin journey. We seriously have a deep commitment to creating 10 million new Bitcoiners who really understand what's going on here, who will really fight for monetary freedom and for justice around the world. And so we are very much committed to education. We start with an email series as soon as you become a Swan client, and we'll take you through week after week through various aspects of Bitcoin, from money to the tech to justice to why it's important to financial inclusion and freedom, etc. And of course, we make available several books. We are working on a book ourselves that Corey and I will be publishing. We make ourselves available also on our client services team to answer any question you have about Bitcoin every single day. We have a great team of Bitcoiners who are answering questions from new clients about Bitcoin and how to store your Bitcoin and what it is and where can I learn more about it, what are the best resources, etc. And we also have Swan Private. And for Swan Private, we are here to guide you on your Bitcoin journey as well, and make ourselves available to you as dedicated service representative, help out with taxes and retirement account setups and custody, self-custody, etc. We'll be there to support you along that way. And as we like to say, the reward at the end of this Bitcoin journey is your legacy. This is what we're talking about here, is legacy money. And as Elise and Lynn spoke about today, it's very, very exciting about what's going on. Bitcoin has really emerged as a player on the global monetary stage, and we are watching all of this play out in real time. The technology is advancing at a rapid pace. We're listening to senators and the SEC chairman and other lawmakers discuss Bitcoin in positive ways, about including it into the regulatory environment in positive ways. We also have we need to stay vigilant about how all of this goes down. It's not, you know, going to be easy. We need to protect our own privacy, our own freedoms. And so we need to fight as well to continue to educate lawmakers and citizens around the world about Bitcoin. That's it for this week. Next week, in 2 weeks, we'll be with Preston Pish and Andy Edstrom to get a quarterly update on the state of the Bitcoin world. So join us for that. If you're more into the audio type stuff, you can download the podcasts at swansignalpodcast.com. Subscribe to the feed there. All right. Thanks so much, everyone. See you next time. Thanks so much to Lynn and Elise for joining us today. You can find Lynn on Twitter at Lynn Alden Contact. That's LynAlden Contact. And you'll find Elise on Twitter at Elise Killeen. That's AlyseKilleen. On behalf of the Swan team, thank you so much for joining us. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Swan Signal Podcast. It is really fun to join us live on the YouTube broadcasts at youtube.com/swansignal. You can head over there now, subscribe, and turn on notifications. There's a lot of fun going on in the live chats of those. And you can subscribe to this podcast, if you're not already, at swansignalpodcast.com. Swan Signal is a production of Swan Bitcoin, the best way to accumulate Bitcoin at swanbitcoin.com. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you next time.